That takes us to 7:13 in the morning here on Upfront. I'm Kat Brooks. Brian Edwards-Tekert is on vacation. Many listeners know that I grew up in Las Vegas, Nevada, very close to a nuclear test site, and a lot of where I learned to be an organizer and an activist came from my mother, who used to go to the test site and cross the line and be peaceably arrested on a regular basis. And then, of course, turned around as I was being a little more forcefully arrested by the Oakland Police Department and say, "What are you doing?" And I say, "I'm following in your footsteps, Mom." And then recently I was in Asia with my daughter, and we went to the Hiroshima Memorial. And I was stunned that Jaden, my child, had never heard of Hiroshima. They're not teaching that in school anymore, which for me is just terrifying, that we would allow such a critical piece of history to be forgotten, especially as we have now returned to a time where nuclear war is a possibility. So with that, and turning to a place where there is nuclear tensions as well, tensions are high in the predominantly Muslim region of Kashmir that sits between India and Pakistan, and to which both countries claim total propriety, as India's Hindu nationalist government has revoked Article 370, effectively annexing Kashmir completely, both angering Pakistan and frightening Kashmiris who are bracing themselves for violence. We are joined this morning by Ather Zia, a poet and political anthropologist who teaches anthropology and gender studies at the University of Northern Colorado, Greeley. She is the author of Resisting Disappearance, Military Occupation, and Women's Activism in Kashmir. Good morning, Ather.
Good morning, Kat.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So for our listeners, can you help us understand the history of Article 370 and what it is?
Well, Article 370 is a constitutional arrangement that was drafted between India and Kashmir. And this came into effect in 1954. This is after 1947, when India and Pakistan gained their freedom, they become separate countries. Kashmir was undecided. Most of the Kashmiris, they wanted to be an independent state. They wanted to be a sovereign nation. That's what they had been fighting for before 1947. Mm-hmm. But the logic of partition was that they have to join either India or Pakistan. So that was the status quo at the moment. And then what actually ended up happening is, because this Himalayan kingdom was dominantly Muslim, but it was ruled by a Hindu monarch. And he was also sitting on the fence. And then he inclined towards India. And that's when the war broke out between India and Pakistan. That's the first war that they fought right after they gained independence. And that's over Kashmir. So what ended up happening is that half of Kashmir is administered and controlled and occupied by Pakistan at the moment, and the rest of it is controlled and occupied by India. What the Indian part, which was under India's control, what they ended up doing was, the leadership at that moment, which had the control, which was also predetermined by India, they ended up drafting this constitutional arrangement, which is called the 370. So it actually gave this this part autonomy. And this autonomy meant that they would have their separate flag, they would have their separate prime minister, president, so they would act as an autonomous unit. The only three subjects that would lie with India were communications, defense, and foreign affairs. So that has been the constitutional arrangement through which Kashmir, the Indian occupied Kashmir, and India work together. But what ended up happening was that India, immediately after it was affected in 1954, it started eroding it slowly by presidential orders. And what happened very recently on August 5th, I think, in the morning, was that they annulled it. They made it void, and they actually did not directly attack the article, which takes the territorial sovereignty of Kashmiris away. And why I mentioned territorial sovereignty, because the Article 370 effectively give the Kashmiris autonomy, but it had been eroded and it was a shell of its former version. The only thing that remained was that they still had territorial sovereignty. That meant that they had the right to franchise, they had political rights, and people from India could not come in, which did not mean that they were not inside Kashmir doing business and having everything to do with, controlling Kashmir. But they still could not buy land, they still could not affect do any kind of, you know, they did not have franchise. So that has been effectively done away with. But they haven't attacked it directly. They have actually amended an article which kind of inserts this clause, how to amend the constitution. So it's very dangerous for India. If it's a death knell for Kashmir's status, if it's a death knell for Kashmir's self-identity, it's also a death knell for Indian democracy.
And the fears that Kashmiris are having, one is that this will then allow more Hindus to just sort of come in, buy land, settle, and take over the region, correct?
Yes, that's the fear, that settler colonialism has been put into motion very brazenly. It doesn't mean that that has not been happening in different forms. The control, major control, till now has always resided with New Delhi. And they have always had these predetermined rigged governments, predetermined governments that have been put in place by rigged elections. That's what they have done so far. But this effectively means that now there will be a flux of Indian settlers inside Kashmir. And that has been a long-standing fear of Kashmiris, which is why they were connecting to 370, which is why they were 370 has a very important article in it, which is 35A, which was the crux, which is the territorial sovereignty. So when people say Article 370 has been done away with and Kashmiris are, protesting it, they're not actually protesting the relationship with India. They're actually protesting the loss of territorial sovereignty. That's why they were protecting it thus far, because they did not want to be overrun by Indians. And now the demon of settler colonialism looms large, and you can easily see it on Twitter, what the Indians are doing. You can easily see Indian civilians talking about marrying white Kashmiri girls, because Kashmiri girls are famous to be very beautiful. And they're already talking about all of this misogynist, patriarchal, military, industrial complex kind of vocabulary that they're using. Some of them are also trying to think that, you know, they want to buy this piece of land because Kashmir is known as the Switzerland of Asia. So all of that nationalistic, misogynistic, patriarchal desires that Hindu nationalist India has, they are coming to light as of now, as we speak.
And there were signs that something was coming, correct? There was sort of a series of events that happened that had Kashmiris preparing for something.
Oh, it was a panic. My parents are there. My family is there. And all of them have been in this, suspended animation kind of for the last, I would say, 1 month, because India flew in more troops. So this is technically an annexation that has happened, but it is so masked because we think of India as a democracy. Kashmir is under Armed Forces Special Powers Act, which gives the Indian Army the authority to kill and to arrest anyone on mere suspicion. And that's what's caused so many human rights abuses and casualties thus far, more than 70,000. So what was happening in the last 15 days was that there were a series of orders that were coming out. So the first, the government said that these orders are leaked. And what were these orders? That they were ordering more troops inside Kashmir. So and it was also pointing to a law and order situation. The people were like, okay, so nothing is happening at the moment. So what is this law and order situation? So it kind of started building from there. And then they started taking people out, non-locals, students, and then they also took the pilgrims who had come for this annual visit to a Himalayan shrine, this Hindu shrine called Amarnath. So they actually emptied the valley of those pilgrims as well. They bussed them out to the airport. They had big aircrafts that were actually flying in the troops. They had them get these people out, and then they also had non-local students. But what was actually happening was they were confounding the confusion. That's what even the governor, who is not an elected official but has been instituted by New Delhi. He actually went on record, and other bureaucrats went on record saying, people should maintain calm. Nothing is happening. This is just routine. And when the non-locals started leaving, that was the moment when Kashmiris really, really started panicking. And I was talking to my family back there, and they were like, we're stocking up. We don't know what's happening. But Kashmiris are very canny. They're very political. They know what was coming. They know that 370 would be attacked. They knew that 35A was under attack. But this government has been very sneaky and deceitful. There is a case in the Supreme Court of India, which is which is against 35A. So most eyes were focused on the Supreme Court because they thought that it would be in the Supreme Court that this would be struck down. No one really thought that this kind of siege, this kind of the right now Kashmir is under siege. There is a complete information abyss. We do not know what's happening inside. The news that's trickling in is from these very choppy Wi-Fis from the hospitals, and journalists have no say. They are not able to. There's no one in Kashmir right now that can be reached. I don't know what's happening to my parents. I don't know what's happening to my family. And that's not just me. That's all of us right now, the diaspora and people who are living in a voluntary exile because we cannot be there and speak for Kashmir.
And that's because they've shut down internet and all other forms of communication, correct?
Everything is shut down. There is no cable television except for one kind of television that's called Dish, and I don't know how many people have that. There is no internet. There is no cell phones. You cannot. The only phones working in Kashmir are satellite phones that probably are the top bureaucrats. And the suspicion is, and most of the speculation says that even the Jammu Kashmir police force, which is drawn from the local population, they have no say in the matters. They're also ignorant of what's happening, and it's mostly the non-locals who are kind of the hegemonic bodies right now controlling every piece of information inside Kashmir.
How much of this do you think was posturing to Pakistan?
There is posturing to Pakistan, that's part of it. And there is also, so right now Pakistan is also, it's kind of in these throes of what's happening. And I think the LOC is aflame. And on the LOC, what's happening right now is there is a...
Define LOC for the listeners.
Oh, the LOC is the line of control which exists between the two parts of Kashmir, the Pakistan-administered Kashmir and the Kashmir that is being controlled by India. So that part is called Azad Kashmir. The LOC is where, people call it the de facto border, but I think that is an erroneous term that we should not be using because that makes us think that these are two countries here. But these are actually two parts of the same region, the Azad Kashmir and Jammu and Kashmir from the side where India controls it. So that's where they have been fighting, and the troop reinforcement has happened there as well. So recently when Imran Khan came to America and President Trump mentioned intervention and mentioned mediating between the two countries, and then also we see some resurrection of Pakistan and U.S. ties, and we see some kind of camaraderie happening there. And with the mediation, because India maintains Kashmir is an internal matter, India maintains, which is erroneous because it's an internationalized issue, it's on the UN resolutions. And even in 1972, when Pakistan and India got together and they did the Simla agreement, they decided that no one country is going to talk about or do anything unilaterally. So in that sense, India has gone against its own constitution. It has gone against its own agreements that it have been put in place. So Pakistan is protesting that, and it has decided to go to the UN Security Council. We don't know how far that would go, but there's still kind of news trickling in what Pakistan's response will be. But there is posturing happening because there is this very strong Hindu element in all of this. Since the BJP, the right-wing Hindutva, which has the core Hindu nationalist supremacist policy, since they have come into power in 2014, we have seen this posturing happening, these skirmishes and fighting off and on with Pakistan to kind of like, you know, lay down their hegemony in the region. And then also this move is kind of trying to take the carpet from under the feet of Pakistan, because Pakistan also has claim to the disputed region. So there's a lot of posturing going on there, not just to Pakistan, but also to the world global leaders, that we are leaders in the region and we will not take anyone's mediation.
You talked about the skirmishes, the fighting between Pakistan and India. How has that impacted Kashmiris? And particularly I'm talking about the violence in the region and the reports of rape being used as a weapon of war.
What being used as a weapon of
rape.
War?
Rape.
Oh, yeah. So that has been, like, it's been a long-standing thing. So This all started in 1989, the new form of fighting that Kashmiris took up. They got trained on the other side in the Azad Kashmir, of course, with Pakistani support. And ever since then, troops have been more and more troop reinforcements has happened on the Indian from the Indian portion, which it controls. We have more than 700,000 Indian military right now inside Kashmir. And recently, they added more than 40,000 soldiers to this number. So what's been happening in the last 33 years is that it has total impunity, and they are not accountable to anyone. There is no soldier that has been tried, and there is no soldier that has been taken into account for what the kind of human rights abuses that they have done inside Kashmir. Rape has been used as a weapon of war. Human Rights Watch has documented that. There are several cases of mass rapes. There is no end to sight. No one has been held responsible. But there are tomes and tomes of documentation that human rights activists have done, that people like me also have written about and, you know, been active trying to bring awareness to those. So that has been done. People have been killed. People have been disappeared. Enforced disappearances have been documented from 8,000 to 10,000 people. And they have come down, but the new forms of punishment and punishing Kashmiris have come into force very recently in the last 4 years. Pellet guns have been very, very rampant, which have taken vision of lots and lots of Kashmiris. And it is the known case of first mass blinding in Kashmir. So all forms of technology of terror that a government can use. And the other thing is that right now, with what India has done, is that they have essentially moved from an occupation to an annexation, with flying in of more forces and with this kind of siege that they have laid down. So what our fears are, for the last 33 years, we have witnessed lots and lots of human rights abuse. And on the LOC is more or less inflamed. In 2003, there was...
Arthur, I've got the tyranny of the clock. I've got to end it there. If you've got like 10 seconds of a final thought.
Well, we need to tell the world that Kashmir is under siege, and we need to know why. And why this is an extreme shock that the autonomy has been taken. But the problem is that we are fearing settler colonialism, and we are fearing a lot of bloodshed that might be impending.
Athazia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Athazia is a poet and political anthropologist who teaches anthropology and gender studies at the University of Northern Colorado Greeley. Coming up next, hate crimes and Donald Trump. We'll talk to Valerie Martinez-Ebers, a professor of political science, about her findings that in counties that hosted Trump rallies, hate crimes spiked by 226%. That's next after the news.